So if we start with Finland, there's an experiment with the universal basic income going on there. What do you think about the model that they're taking?
It's not a full basic income in this Finland experiment. What they're doing is they're taking 2,000 unemployed and randomly chosen from across the country, and they're giving them a basic income for 2 years. So each month they will receive 560 euros equivalent, and they don't have to take any job, but if they do take a job, they won't lose their basic income. And the idea behind it is to see whether the government has to force people to take jobs. Now, basically, if they have a basic income, I think people will continue to look for jobs, look for work, because they want to increase their income. But it's not a full basic income, because a full basic income would mean that everybody in a community receives it. Whether you're employed, unemployed, outside the labour force, everyone, every man, every woman, and a child, a smaller amount. So for me, it's only a test of part of what a basic income would be.
So what are the other options of testing? Only the full scale?
My own view is that it's better to choose a community. If you want to test it, you have a pilot. You choose a community and then say to everybody in that community, you're going to receive the basic income. It's up to you how you spend it. Yours as a right. You can earn other income, and you pay the standard tax on earned income. Okay? Now, that scheme, I'm advising in California, going there next week, where there's going to be a pilot in California, and I'm saying they should definitely have that as a model there. And in Ontario, they're also planning to do a basic income pilot, and in a number of other places they're talking about doing it, in the Netherlands, in Spain, a small one in an Italian city. And we've done pilots, big pilots, where everybody in communities get this basic income in India and in Africa, and they work very well.
So basically, a universal basic income increased productivity, and what are the results?
What we found is if you have a basic income, people actually work more, not less, and they're more productive when they work. And one of the reasons is that the existing systems of social security are what we call means tested, right? Which means that only if you are poor do you get the benefit, all right? Well, that means that if you go from having a benefit into a low wage job and you lose the benefits, you are effectively paying a tax rate, a very high tax rate. Supposing your benefits are worth 100 euros a week, say, and you go into a job that pays 120, right? You've lost the 100, lose the benefit, so you only got an extra 20. So you're effectively paying a tax rate of 5/6, so 80%, over 80%. And that means that it's a huge disincentive to taking a low-wage job, right? With a basic income, you would get the extra, whatever you get, whatever you earn, right? And you pay the standard tax. But if you were doing it, if you were in the precariat, you're probably on a low wage, and you're low benefit, but you would lose all the benefit going to take the low wage. You wouldn't, it's crazy. So what happens is that people either don't do those jobs, or they do the jobs in the black economy. So they don't declare it. Well, neither of those things are good. So for me, it's unique. It's a basic income would be much better as an incentive for people to take jobs.
And how would the basic income be funded?
Well, I mean, there are various ways of funding a basic income. One, you can phase out subsidies that governments give to corporations and middle classes and tax allowances and things like that, and replace existing means-tested benefits. So you have a basic income, and then if you've got a disability, for example, you get an extra amount because you have extra costs, right? Or if you're a woman who's pregnant and having a baby, then you'd get extra amount. Or if you're a mother looking after a baby, you get an extra amount. So you can arrange it so that instead of the means-tested benefits, you get across the board, and then you have a tax back for the high earners. But you can also build up a capital fund in the country from high tech or natural resources or whatever, so that gradually as the fund invests in things and starts getting income back into the fund, then from the fund you pay out the basic income. And then gradually the basic income would go up as the fund expands. Now that model is done in Alaska. It's the Alaska Permanent Fund, it's called. So the Alaska Permanent Fund has been built up with taking part of the profits from oil in Alaska, build up the fund, and now they hand out a basic income to everybody at the end of each year. So there are different ways of funding it. I don't think it's a matter of which way you go.
Okay. Well, you warned in the past that with the rising number of precariat, there is a danger of people grasping extreme ideas, populist ideas, more easily. How would universal basic income prevent that?
Well, I think one of the main reasons why people vote for extremists is insecurity. And if you're insecure, and you're earning low earnings, and you see up there that some people are earning a lot of huge incomes, and they're secure, you get angry, right? You get angry. And the danger we have is that people who are insecure, and they're part of the precariat, and that this part that does not have a lot of education, and they look back and their parents, or themselves, they used to have jobs that, like shipbuilding or car building or mining or anything, but now they don't have that. So they look backwards and they're angry because they feel they've lost something, right? So they listen to Donald Trump or Marine Le Pen or Orban, you know, different types of people like that, and they're dangerous because they are supporting these dictatorial neo-fascist people, and I'm very worried that a growing number of people are supporting them, and look what we're getting with Trump. He is a danger to the world, a huge danger.
In Slovenia we have a trade union Mladi Plus and the trade union of the precariats, which all handle the precar workers. Is that just a Slovenian specialty, or is there something going on the European, on worldwide level?
It's taking place in a growing number of countries where you've got precariat movements, you've got precariat elements in unions, in Italy like that, in Spain they had this. Precariat movements are growing, and I think the unions, the labor unions, the old labor unions, have to transform themselves to reach to the precariat. Otherwise, precariat union stay separate. Because they have a different agenda. If you're in the precariat, you don't have the same agenda as the old proletariat. And it's interesting that for a long time, the old labor unions were against basic income. They were ignoring the precariat, or they said the precariat must become like the proletariat. And now I think they're listening, because They're not appealing to the precariat, because the precariat hasn't got the same agenda. It wants to be able to work, it wants freedom, it wants to ecological issues to be there, it wants to be a different, more diversified, with more attention to art, more attention to creativity, whereas the old labor unions seem to want everybody in full-time jobs, you know, that orientation. I was invited to Spain last week in Madrid by big international unions. And I said, look, you have to change, because the enemy of the old proletariat is the boss, a corporation, right? Focus on the boss. For the precariat, the boss may be changing all the time. Right? May I have the same boss this week as next week, right? The protagonist is the state for the precariat. You want better social policies, you want more distribution, you want a basic income scheme. These are different issues, right? So that the orientation of the precariat is towards the state, the orientation of the proletariat is to the employer. It's a different mindset.
You said in the past that you think that the precariat will connect in the future and it will change, it should change the social and politics of the world. How does that differ from the Marxist view of the proletarian revolution? I mean, I kind of understood your view as there will be a precarian revolution, but with the fact that those who work in those kind of jobs have less income, less stability, they need to focus every day on what they will earn the next day and how they will survive.
Well, I think I'm not expecting or predicting revolution. That was the 20th century. I do think there's going to be revolt, as we're seeing it. Revolt, you know, people taking to the streets, taking pressure, demanding change. But it's a different type of change. I mean, the precariat wants the commons. It wants to revive the commons. It wants ecological. It wants equal rights. It wants to be able to do different types of work together, not just being in a job 100% of the time. It wants to be focusing on education in a broader sense. Whereas the old proletariat revolution was wanting the means of production. You know, we don't want, what's the point? Means of production. You know, you've got your own means of production in your hands. You own the means of production. The old proletariat didn't have the means of production. What you want is some control for your time. You want security. You want the access to public space and public amenities, so that you can live in the polis, live in the agora, and participate as an equal. Okay? These are all different things from the old proletarian revolution.
Well, I would disagree that we have the means of production in our hands. I mean, we all can work, and this is some neoliberal agenda that everyone can succeed.
No, but the neoliberal agenda is that there are no institutions of social solidarity. And I believe the precariat wants a sense of community, wants a sense of citizenship. It wants institutions that can stop commodification, stop marketization. Whereas the neoliberal wants everything to be marketized, everything to be commodified, and everything to be atomized, individualized. Well, if you want to be a neoliberal, you end up sick. The stress, the tension, the competitiveness. Okay? And I think that the educated part of the precariat wants to create a sense of community, control of time, the ability to live in the community, and to sustain the ecology. For the neoliberal, the ecology is worthless, has no value. Has no value, except if it can be used for making profit. All right? For the precariat, we want the ecology. We want the commons. This is where we live. This is where we, as collective groups, live. And I think the mentality is completely different. So we're not in the old communist orientation. We're not in the neoliberal orientation. We're going back to the Enlightenment with a sense that we want to be able to work on our enthusiasms in different ways. And this is the change in orientation. That's seven questions.
As for your interview from May 2015, when you said that the global income distribution system has been demolished and the wages are stagnating or getting lower, do you think that could be solved with a kind of new deal?
No, I think I've written this new book, which has just come out, called The Corruption of Capitalism. And the thesis of the book is that what's happened is neoliberalism has created conditions for rentier capitalism. And rentier capitalism means that the returns to property have gone up and up. And the returns to work and production gone down. And the rentier system with intellectual property, financial property and so on means that more and more wages are stagnating, even the profits from production aren't going up much, but rentier is going up over here. And the first thing we've got to do is bring rental income back down, dismantle all the means by which that's happening. All right? And the new income distribution system, in my view, should have a basic income at the bottom and these supplements I was talking about, needs-based, and you capture much of the rental income and build up capital funds, like patents, for example. The maker of this machine, right, owns the patent, and as a result of the patent, they're making super profits. Why do they have patents? It's against the market. You cannot defend it from a neoliberal point of view. You cannot defend it from an economic point of view. It is a way of rigging the system to get rental income.
You can defend it by saying that there will be more research if there will be high profits.
No. That breaks down too, as I argued in my book, that argument. Because most of the research that leads to patents is publicly funded. Okay, so you and me pay for it. So it's not, if we're paying for it, why should the man who gets the patent earn all the income? It should be part of us. So that's a good argument for saying part of the rental income should be put into a capital fund. Because we've funded that research. The second thing with it is that in actual fact, there's no correlation between the existence of patents and market efficiency or stimulus to more research. Most of the patents are bought up by multinational corporations, right? So for example, IBM or Google or these big companies, they have thousands of patents. Most of the patents they have, they've bought from others. They didn't invest in the research, they bought it because they are powerful. So once you have a system of what I call plutocratic corporations, they are patent hoovers. You know this? And that's what's happened. So you once this system takes off, most of the profits from this rental system go to plutocratic corporations or plutocrats who've got billions. And they increase their billions by buying up more patents. So if you invent a new machine, they may pay you $1 million, and you they get turned it into $1 billion. So the system has been constructed, which is anti-market, anti-economic.
I understand that this is also a problem with academic articles where
absolutely.
Knowledge is...
Absolutely, absolutely. It's ridiculous, because once then they get copyright, you get copyright on academic articles, or even a book, right? That means you, with the existing laws under the World Intellectual Property Organization, which all these treaties, that means that you get the monopoly income for the whole of your life plus 70 years. It's crazy, because it's purely determined by the institutional structure. It's not out there in nature. It's not natural. It's because they've strengthened the institutional structures to enable them to get all that copyright. So if Bill Gates was living and did his inventions 30 years ago and hadn't changed the rules, international rules, he would not be the world's wealthiest person. It was only because the rules were changed that enabled him to get so much extra money. So, you know, the great inventors of the past, they didn't become super, super, super wealthy. They made money, but they had to suffer competition. And the whole system is a corrupted one, because it's not a free market. So we have a situation that I would say we've got to dismantle that and use part of that money to build up a fund to pay for a basic income, so that people like you, me, and everybody would have a basic income and be able to build their lives.